If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming up on this week's show, a legendary FPS returns.
An amazing new Spectrum clone.
And we go inside the world of Sega with Roger Hector.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our friends, our sponsor, a Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen their incredible latest title, 50 Indie Games That Changed the World? Now, this is the ultimate celebration of what it takes to get a video game made outside of the typical AAA studio system, including pixelated classics like Shovel Knight and Dead Cells, to masterpieces like Super Meat Boy and Limbo, all covered in here as well, and weighing in at a massive 450 plus pages. You can check it out on the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at Replay Events, who are bringing the UK's biggest retro games market to Cardiff this month on Sunday, October the 19th at the Utilita Arena. So go along, grab yourself some great retro gaming bargains, meet like-minded people. Doors open at 11 a.m. and under 16s go free with an adult after one. Get your tickets right now at cardiffgamingmarket.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 501. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show, the podcast that comes out every single Friday and takes you on a nostalgic journey back to the golden age of video games. Loads of nostalgia sprinkled throughout the show, but also bringing you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro. New games, new developments, new systems coming out every week. We'll let you know all the big headlines in the first part of the podcast. And we welcome on veterans of the industry for a chat about their career on the show each week as well. Now, today we're going to be continuing our massive episode 500 celebrations. Just want to say as well, a huge thank you. How much fun was last week's show? Not only streaming it live to the patrons, but I imagine you guys actually sat down and watched that huge compilation of all our listener good luck and congratulations messages at the end.
Yeah. It was really nice. And I'm just amazed with your editing skill as well. Just pumping out these episodes. You know, this is how it's going to be. We're in the 500s, guys. This is pretty crazy. And, you know, we're still keeping that consistent good guests on the podcast, and Roger Hector is definitely that. We had him on the last episode, and he was talking about his history in Atari, the early days of coin-op, and we're going into the kind of 16-bit world now. We're going into Sega, absolutely huge company, but also Disney and some of the stuff that he was doing with Disney, which is kind of your jam, isn't it, Joe?
Yeah, it was really, really good. I was actually telling somebody at work about Roger Hector today. And I was like, oh yeah, after Atari, he did EA, he did Sega, he did Disney. And then he actually went on to, which we didn't cover because it wasn't video game related, but he went on to Universal Studios.
Yes.
And he turned around and he went, what was he going for? Like the full bingo card, like of all the big companies. And I was like, yeah, he went far off. But really, really, really fun interview. We basically cover, you know, the 70s and the 80s in part one. And this is more kind of the late 80s. Early to mid 90s, isn't it?
And he's bringing stuff like you know, his experience of branding, but also his experience of you know, mascots. He managed to get those into video games, particularly with EA and the starting of EA Sports, that growing into, you know, later on, of course, with Mickey Mouse, which is one of the world's biggest mascots. So, you know, having a responsibility of how Disney characters are going to be presented on video games and then going into Sonic. Really interesting interview.
And also, I'm very excited to hear the story of Michael Jackson's involvement with Sonic 3 as well, which might throw up a few surprises in the interview this week. So I know there's been a lot written about that over the years. So Roger Hector, our special guest this week, is going to be on part two of the audio podcast for our YouTube viewers. We are on YouTube now. That'll be out on Monday. So looking forward to our part two of that massive interview. But of course, before we do that, we bring you up to speed on what's been happening in retro from over the last week. Just to mention as well, Ravi and I are heading out to Germany next week, aren't we?
Yeah.
Going to the huge Amiga 40 celebrations.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing. We've been to previous Amiga Germany events, but this one seems like it's the peak. I've heard they've sold over 1,000 tickets for Saturday,
wow,
which is just bonkers. I'm going to be on stage interviewing Eric Simon as well. So that should be really interesting, talking about, some great gaming history. There's going to be loads of guests, actually. Some really good stuff. There's some DJs as well. Remute is one I want to see. We've talked about him on the podcast quite a lot, and he's, put all these albums out on different formats on Mega Drive carts and stuff like that. So, having him performing live will be really cool. Hopefully,
find a drink at the bar and get him on the podcast, Ravi.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully, get him on.
get him on the podcast. Yeah,
yeah. So it's massive 2-day celebration for the Amiga's 40th birthday happening in Germany. I think there are still some tickets left for the Sunday time of recording.
Oh yeah, I think they're quite hard to get. Yeah, but yeah, my tip is email the team and say, there might be a few around.
Yeah, now when Marcus, the organiser, Ravi, what did you say that for? My email went about that.
Bombarded.
Yeah, but if you are coming along next weekend in Germany for the Amiga 40, come say hi. Really hyped for that. But of course, lots happening this week. Now, of course, now that we are into October, countdown to Halloween is on. See the pumpkins and the
you boys are
Halloween
so now. Excited about it. I'm excited about Halloween.
I'm never like, oh, it's Halloween. It's always Dan.
I am. I'm one of these guys. There's a big place in the UK called The Range, which is like where you basically go get furniture and random stuff. They dedicate the whole top floor to Halloween around this time of year. Bit of Christmas stuff creeping in. I started walking around and looking at all the tat. I always liked Halloween. But of course,
shining.
Do you remember a few years ago, actually, didn't we do a landmark episode? I think it was episode 300, when we recorded it at my house in my studio on Halloween.
We did. And my daughter was only 1.5. And your wife made it like proper, like welcoming for all the trick or treaters, and we were trying to do episode 300.
The doorbell kept ringing. Yeah,
the doorbell every 10 seconds.
My little baby girl was dressed as Donald Duck, running around with a pumpkin.
I did try to get these guys to dress up for it, but they didn't. Yeah, sports. But I mean, you do get into creepy video games, I know, all year round for you, Joe. Particularly this time of year, they've got a bit of an excuse to get into them, and this is really cool. A legendary FPS game is back.
Yeah,
for 2025 in time for Halloween. You can actually pre-order this right now, actually. This is Blood.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny because of how long we've been doing the podcast for now, obviously 10 years. We covered this in 2019, that Blood had been remastered for PC by Night Dive Studios. And I remember saying, I've always wanted to play Blood. So Blood is in what's the engine called? The Doom engine.
This is the Build engine.
The Build engine game. So it's a Doom clone. We won't call it a boomer shooter. So it's a Doom clone, but obviously it's a horror themed one where you play as basically you're an undead demon guy who's come back to life. I forget his name. But it's very like kind of like turn of the 19th century to 20th century, kind of like that's it. Kind of weaponry. You use a pitchfork and flare guns and Tommy guns and little like Molotov grenades and stuff like that, and you're fighting zombies and demons. It's very kind of like Lovecraftian style art, and I've always really wanted to play. I think the original came out in 95 on PC, but it was never on console. So when it got remastered in 2019 by Night Dive Studios, I was like, oh man, such a shame it's not come to consoles, because of I can't remember what other games they'd done at that point, but, like Power Slave and stuff like that, they were all coming out on console. So it was like out of all of the Build Engine games that I really wanted to get remastered, Blood was the one. But finally, we are getting it at the end of this year. It's coming out in December. I think it's December 12th. And it is going to be coming to Steam. because it is another remaster. So this is the refreshed supply.
I love the name because, it was resupply originally. So, refreshed supply.
So this is refreshed supply. So it's been remastered again. It does look absolutely fantastic. It's coming out on Steam, good old games, as well as PlayStation and Xbox, which I absolutely love.
No Switch, though, interestingly, which most of these games do, don't they?
I don't know if that's because it's quite a violent game and you know what Nintendo are like.
They're not that bad anymore, though. They're not like Mortal Kombat and stuff comes out.
True, it could be.
Might happen eventually, you never know. Might be working on it.
It's interesting. We had Kevin Kielstrom on the podcast, episode 454, and he's talking about all the design that went into Blood and how they did a lot of, like, you know, they actually built the creatures and then did a lot of the art based on that. It's really interesting. It was a shareware game as well, originally.
Yeah.
A lot of them were back then, weren't they? Yeah, a lot of the FPS games.
I'm wondering if this has the... it is the multiplayer one called Bloodbath. I wonder if they're going to bring that back, you know, the multiplayer capabilities of it. I'm sure they will.
That'd be cool. Well, with this one, it does have, like, community mods. And then I believe is an extra episode which is coming out later. So you get the kind of like the base game, and then there's an episode 2 called Biopsy, which just says coming soon. Like I say, I'm not familiar with the original Blood, so I don't know if that's a new, completely new kind of like, you know, campaign, or if that is an old one that, you know, was released back in the day and now it's coming out. But it looks like there's quite a few episodes on there, which is cool. So a lot to get your teeth sunk into. But I'm really looking forward to this one. I love, Doom clone games. They're just easy to play. They're not like Call of Duty is easy to play, but it's intense. Do you know what I mean?
It's just
fun to pick up and just play.
I think it's cool as well to me that you've been kind of revisiting these games that you missed when they originally came out. You're playing Heretic and Hexen as well. So I think
having these
nice re-releases that are nicely packaged, work with modern displays, modern systems, good way to catch up on like legendary games that we didn't play first time around, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, you just mentioned, I think I've mentioned Heretic and Hexen the last 3 episodes, but they did come out on console, but I hate to say it, the PC was always the original superior version. Quake was the same. I played through the Night Dive version of that. Power Slave, or whatever, was it Power Slave it was called? Yeah.
Exhumed as well.
Exhumed, Power Slave, yeah. I played through the Night Dive version of that. I had it on PlayStation. I also have the Sega Saturn version now. But the PC version was always the better version. And these games are generally based on either the PC version or the best version of it, all parts of the best versions of it to give you kind of best modern experience, which is great.
All the console fans are going, Joe, you traitor, but you're one of us.
No, the PC always won on FPSs, I think.
This does look awesome. I mean, one thing that people always talk about with FPS games is playing it with a keyboard's a lot nicer than using a controller. Which I'm with you on that, Joe, but I know a lot of people are like, keyboard for life. It does turn out that you can actually play this with a controller or a keyboard. It does support both. This new version of it, high resolution 4K monitor support, unlock frame rates as well, extended modding, including existing mods, rewritten netcode supporting up to 8 players on the game, local split screen online co-op, CD and MIDI music support on there as well. And it includes the original Blood along with the Plasma Pack and Cryptic Passage add-ons. So if you're a Blood fan, sounds like there's loads in there as well. Pretty decent price on Steam at the moment. The pre-order 17% off, so it's £20. That's 74 good. Pence. So, like you said, coming out in a couple of months' time, 4th of December, available to pre-order right now. Welcome back, Blood. I've not played it before, Joe. I think it might be one that I finally sit down and have a go at. So, yeah.
We'll play it at Christmas.
There we go.
I've got a random question for you, Dan. Did you ever build your Lego? Was it a DeLorean that you had?
The one I started back in 2011?
Yeah.
It's getting there. It's in my coffee table drawer. I do a little bit every year. So maybe that'll be something else I finish this Christmas. I like to take my time with the Lego, as you guys can probably tell. We did cover this on the podcast. I got a feeling it might have been the patrons section of the show maybe a couple of weeks ago.
I think so.
So we'll recap it for everybody else. That there is a surprisingly expensive official Lego Game Boy that you can get hold of. So tell us a backstory on this. We did cover it for patrons, but for everybody else.
A Lego Game Boy has come out. It got announced about 2 months ago. And it got released a week ago, I think, at the point of filming.
You got all in on video.
I know. And basically, yeah, it's official Lego. It's not knockoff or anything like that. And obviously Lego have had a deal with, well, they did the Atari 2600 and then they did the NES one. Now they've done the Game Boy set. And yeah, it was, you know, it was a one-to-one scale sized Game Boy Lego, you know, Lego set, which is awesome. And it came with a little Super Mario Land cartridge and a Zelda Link's Awakening cartridge. And then the screen was basically like a like an insert, like a, I think it was a sticker or an insert. And whatever cartridge you had in the back, then you could put like the screen on basically to represent that game being played. And it was basically just like a scene from one of the games. So it wasn't, it's not a playable Game Boy or anything like that. But obviously,
I've got to do one correction as well, because we did mention when we first covered this story, there were rumors it was going to cost $150 or something, wasn't it? It actually came out at $60.
Oh, there you go.
Completely changes it for me. So I thought this was like way overpriced as the original rumors were.
Yeah, I remember somebody at work telling me who's big into Lego, like they were like, oh, you know, the pence per brick on it's outrageous. You know, but $60 seems a lot more reasonable. And we did say that's going to get modded immediately. Somebody's going to stick a real Game Boy or a Raspberry Pi in there or something. And yeah, the day it came out, this was this came out on an article called The Verge. This is Natalie the Nerd, who has already modded the Game Boy, the Lego Game Boy, and made it into a fully playable Game Boy.
She's used the smallest kit to do it possible. So kind of smallest component to actually have a real Game Boy in there running and working, which looks really cool. But I was also looking on YouTube as well, and there was a couple of people. So there's Natalie, the nerd, who's using the original hardware. There's also another guy called Ferriman Hero, and he's got it running like Raspberry Pi style. I'm not sure if he's using a Raspberry Pi, but he can play Doom on it. And he's saying he's going to make...
That's not original hardware, then. No,
he's going to make a component kit that will hopefully mean people can do conversions. He might do a small run of those. So there might be a kit coming out, you know, to convert your Lego Game Boy, which would be really cool to see.
Yeah, well, what Natalie the Nerd's done is she's used a custom motherboard, but it's parts from a Game Boy Pocket, I believe, to get it working. And they did have to make a custom 3D printed Lego piece for the A and B buttons to work. So what's cool about this is all the buttons, you know, the Lego buttons do work. It was just to get the A and B button to work, she had to get a custom back piece inside of it, like for the connectors, but it's still Lego, basically. Obviously, it's a custom piece she's had made up, but it is still made of like Lego with Lego connectors and stuff like that, which is cool. She says she's still got some bits to do on it to kind of like refine it. But once that's done, she'll, reveal more on a blog and, you know, I believe including like steps on how to do it yourself and stuff. But it's just funny, like these things never take long, but it's like the day it came out.
Yeah. I didn't expect it to be quite that quick, if I'm honest. But yeah.
So, Joe, you resell quite a few games. Have you done any Game Boy repairs yourself?
No, nothing like this. No, I solder batteries, but basically usually any sort of like broken consoles. Unless it's like I've replaced a few screens on Game Boys. When I say screens, I just mean like the screen lens.
I've tried to replace the screens and like taking the film off and stuff, and kind of got quite deep into it. And I've always had like a problem with something pushing on a bit of the screen, getting black marks or something like that. So I can imagine this might be a bit trickier
massively. Yeah. But yeah, no, nothing. Like this. I've never done any sort of like repairs or anything like this. I've took stuff apart and cleaned it. That's about as far as it gets, and replaced batteries. So
I've got a feeling last year, didn't you and I make a New Year's resolution where we said, right, this is going to be the year that we learn to solder properly. We have to send our systems away to get recapped. You've gone further than I have, to be fair.
I was going to say, I'm quite pleased with myself. I can do like a Game Boy battery in like a couple of minutes, and I can do a pretty clean job of it. But you were going to give me your Game Gear. Well, you know, lend me your game gear. And I was just going to YouTube it and follow it for the capacitors, because if some people say it's really easy and some people say it's the hardest one. So I was just like, I'll give it a bash, but I've yet to get my hands on one, or come over and actually I've been over to your house a few times the last few months, but I've just not picked it up.
I might let you practice on something a bit less valuable, maybe an old graphics card or something. Interestingly though, I've got to give a shout out to Dan, who left us a nice message last week. He did mention we should cover the Ouzebox more, which is like this homebrew console that he's made. Okay, and he actually did send me the kit to make my own. So well, I've got to solder it all together myself. So I've got to get my soldering skills a bit up to scratch to give that a go. Hopefully I'm going to do a video on that at some point in the next few months. So,
I just, and this is no disrespect to Dan, who's made the Ouzebox, but disrespect to our Dan. You know, episode of Simpsons where they go to Itchy and Scratchy Land and the one of the robots takes its helmet off and like you can see all the components. And Marge goes, "See, Homer, look at all those components. That's why your robot never worked."
This should power on. Ah, there's no chips on the board.
I can just imagine that with you, Dan.
Either way, it'll be entertaining. So I'll say that. But
I built a monster joystick and I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah,
so.
Which you gave me to fix for you 5 years ago. Yeah. I haven't done that yet. So I'll finish that after I do the Lego DeLorean, Joe. Props to Natalie the Nerd, who is obviously far more skilled than we are in these kind of things. We're getting the Lego Game Boy up and running, so we're going to read more about that. And as you mentioned, she's going to be releasing the plan. She actually sells components as well, so hopefully there will be, I imagine PCBWay can make it one of these boards. Hopefully there will be a lot more of these out there, so if you want to check that out, I'll link that in the show notes. Now, something else that's very cool, if you are a bit of a modder and you want to make your own Spectrum, you got a spare specky case lying around. This is something that I'm still trying to get my head around a little bit, but this is a ZX Spectrum clone that looks really small, about the size of maybe half a 30 centimeter ruler. Really small little board that apparently is a full specky clone that you can fit inside the original case.
Yeah, it's like a 1x1 replica, but it's using modern components. So the thing about this is it's very different from like the Spectrum Next, which it's a kind of future vision of the machine. It's got really expensive components in it. It's quite an expensive machine. This one is aimed to be cheap. So this is like the kind of original Spectrum, which was, quite cheap. I think there's been some mention on forums and stuff. They haven't put the price out yet, but around 40 to 50 euros for this, which sounds like a really decent price. And it uses original hardware, but it's trying to be as close to original kind of setup as possible. So the dimensions, it will fit inside your Spectrum. So it'd be a replacement drop-in board that you can put in. But it has a real Z80 chip with an FPGA next to it as well. So the FPGA can replicate some older kind of hardware functions. It's got better sound as well. So it's got two AY chips in there. It's got the Spectrum modes as well, so you can do 48K, 128K, and a +3. You can choose your different type of Spectrum. It's also got RGB video out. It's got the old tape input output, but you can also just do it through an audio jack. And it runs off 9 to 12 volt power as well. Being able to run it off that, off USB-C as well, I think there's talk of. But it looks like it's really got potential to be a cheap kind of Spectrum replacement. You know, if your old machine's dying, just buy this for a cheap price, drop it in, and then you can, play away at your heart's content.
I find it interesting that it's got the real Z80 and an FPGA on board.
I think that's really cool. And like, this is like the price of FPGAs are getting really, really, really cheap nowadays. So
I have to keep remembering that. It's when I hear FPGA, I think like, £400 Mr. Board, but they have dropped a lot in recent years.
No, so like the Tang Nano is like, around $20 for an FPGA, So these prices are really dropping, and you can use them in a small way to emulate certain chips, just to do little functions. They don't have to be a full FPGA system. I like the idea of having them, supplementing something or being on the side or working with a machine. And this is a nice idea of kind of being able to upgrade the Spectrum.
And obviously being FPGA as well, you can flash cores onto it. Yes, so apparently it's going to be several modes available, 48K original, 128K, Pentagon modes, the Amstrad Plus 3 version of it, the Timex as well. Yeah. I imagine there'll be a few of the dodgy Russian clone cores that you can flash onto it as well.
You've got the Russian Spectrums in there as well,
Yeah, so if that price that you mentioned is true, then I think this could be really popular. Because, if you can basically get an FPGA Spectrum clone that fits inside the original case, I think that's one thing that's really appealing about this. Basically, you can screw it in. It should match up to the case mounts.
And also, we have seen clones of the Spectrum Next as well. So we've seen cheaper FPGAs of the Spectrum Next where you could put the firmware on. I know you can't update it like you can with the Spectrum Next. I think there's some kind of restriction, but you can still kind of do a lot of the functions on a cheaper device. So it is really like the reduction of price in FPGAs. Really amazing, and we're going to be able to see lots more of this. I can't wait to see like little FPGA chips for arcades that you can just put in and replace certain
hanging off your keyring.
You can. Well, the Tang Nano is small enough to do that, definitely.
I mean, I've kind of been dipping my toe into FPGA a little bit, as you guys know. I've got a Spectrum Next, I've got a Mega 65 as well, which actually they released a Commodore PET core for the Mega 65 this week. So I'm looking forward. Again, that's a system that I didn't explore back in the day, really. So, you know, trying out some PET titles in a really accurate way, I think it's going to be really cool. So I think FPGAs, the fact that it's coming down in price as well and opening up to a lot more people, I think that's awesome. And replacing all those broken Spectrums as well, you know, if you've got a case and a keyboard.
The Tang Nano one's so cheap and you can run a NAS on that, you know, you can... I think there's SNES ones coming out and stuff. So loads of different cores are getting developed for these smaller systems.
Fantastic. If you want to read more about that, not available yet, but there is a website with more information. It's on Lotherics website. There's a lot on the Atari and Amiga world as well.
Yes, really good store. Yeah,
from Poland. So have a look at that. There's a page on there dedicated to it, and hopefully will be available to get your hands on very soon. That's something else that I imagine Joe is rather hyped for, being our resident monster, another horror game. This one is a new unofficial, he does drink Monster quite a lot as well, actually. an unofficial GBA port of another horror classic. This one is Clock Tower. Now, it's not a game that I play, but I am aware of the legendary status of Clock Tower.
Yeah, so Clock Tower came out on the Super Nintendo in Japan in 95, I believe it was. And then it got released on, it got ported to the PlayStation, and then the sequels came out on like PS2, etc. I think it was about 3 or 4 Clock Tower games in the end. But never got released on any further Nintendo systems, I don't believe. And then the company that made the games went bankrupt in the early 2000s. The original game was actually ported earlier this year through a limited run and came out on like, you know, PS5, Xbox Series X and Switch, I believe. And I do have the Xbox version of this game still in its cellophane ready to play. And I might play it on Halloween.
But there was apparently a version of it that came out on the PlayStation and the Wonder Swan in 97 as well.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, an updated version, yeah.
It looks quite a scary game. It's a point-and-click adventure game, basically, that plays in real time. Mm. And you play as a girl called Jennifer, I think her name is, and you are in, I want to say you're in an orphanage. And basically, there's several girls, like teenage girls, trying to survive the night who have been stalked by the Scissor Man, who's basically like a childlike monster creature but wears a little blue suit which has like giant gardening shears and will go around murdering people, and the game plays in real time, not too dissimilar to like the likes of like Night Trap.
Yeah, so only with a scarier enemy than those burglars
with a scarier enemy and with you know 16-bit you know 16-bit pixel graphics which look fantastic. And basically, you know, the game's gone on to be like a cult kind of like horror game. You know, I really, really want to play it, but I am actually being a little bit chicken about it because the whole kind of like real time thing, depending if people die and stuff like that, basically depends on what ending you get. And I think there's like 7 or 8 different endings. So for the time, you know, really, really quite a deep game. But it's recently been ported to the Game Boy Advance by a team of, you know, not developers, but fans. And it's been headed by a ROM hacker who's called Bob Schneider, I think it is. Bob Schneider 45, who posted it earlier this month in ROM Hack Plaza. And basically, they've done an English version and a Japanese version of the game, which plays on GBA emulation, as well as it will play on native GBA hardware through a EverDrive cartridge, which I think is wicked.
Game Boy Advance, yeah.
Game Boy Advance, yeah. So yeah, Advance, to be clear, if I keep saying Game Boy. So it's Game Boy Advance. I've always been a big advocate of the Game Boy Advance was a handheld Super Nintendo. I used to think it when I had one, you know, when I was a teenager. I used to always just be like, there's so many Super Nintendo games got ported to Game Boy Advance. And this game absolutely makes sense to, you know, to run on the Game Boy Advance. Like, graphically, it still looks fantastic. They've posted a full playthrough of the game, which is only an hour long. I think the game is only a couple of hours long anyway, because obviously different things happen each time you play it, depending on what you do and stuff in the game. But it looks like an absolute fantastic port of the game. The sound on it sounds fantastic. Like I say, it's been released, you know, translated into English and original Japanese text, because the game, obviously being a 16-bit game originally, was all text. It's not voice acting or anything like that. But one of the main kind of like scary elements of the game was the soundtrack, and also the sound effects of when the Scissor Man would appear. And it's all present, and it all sounds fantastic from the playthrough I've been watching.
Joe, you're giving Ravi nightmares.
I hope so. So yeah, you know, I probably won't play the GBA version. I'll be playing it on the Xbox since I've got it. I've really, really, really cool to see it ported to the GBA. Basically, this article on Time Extension kind of says it was a shame that it never did get ported to the GBA, you know, back in the early 2000s. It would have been very cool to see. Probably a very, very, if it did, desirable game these days, because the Clock Tower games aren't cheap anyway. They're quite rare games to get, you know, on original hardware anyway.
I also think real time is quite creepy in games in general, but particularly in horror games, when you walk out of a room, you come back and something's different. You're like, someone's been in here.
Yeah, somebody's dead.
Out of the room. Yeah, it's like, yeah, stuff like that. It does kind of creep me out a little bit. So
I think that's why I don't want to play it. Because it's that fear of like, if I mess up, I've messed up. And I don't know what I'm doing. I'm going in blind and I don't want to watch a guide of it. Like, I just want to play it. And I think not having that control scares me, basically.
The Scissor Man is coming to get you. it does look really cool. And again, I haven't got, I'm going to flash it off my Game Boy Advance, but I think this might be a game that I check out. I've seen YouTube videos about it before, and I've heard it's kind of, if you're into kind of that era of horror games, it's definitely up there and something you should play, particularly this time of year. So, and this fan port, it is free. I mean, like a lot of these, they don't want to charge for them because obviously it's not an official port. So if you want to download it, play it on emulation or on your flash got on your GBA, that is available now. And something else I imagine they're not going to be charging for when this is finished, because again, this is another unofficial port, but this one looks very impressive. Someone has gone to the effort of recreating something that a lot of Sega Saturn fans feel should have come out on their platform back in the day, Tomb Raider 2.
Yeah, this is... this is really interesting. So, you know, obviously Tomb Raider 2 didn't come out on the Sega Saturn after, interestingly, the first Tomb Raider came out on Sega Saturn first.
Was made for Sega, wasn't it?
It was made for Sega, yeah.
He was a huge, huge fan, Toby was. Toby Gard, the original developer of Sega, and totally went for that. But then it blew up on the PlayStation later on. Yeah,
I didn't even know it was on a Sega Saturn when I was a kid. Always assumed it was a PlayStation game and a PlayStation IP growing up. But obviously, you know, fans, they want to see it running on the Sega Saturn number two. But what's really interesting is the way they've made this happen is basically they've took assets of Tomb Raider 2 from the PC version of the game. They've took the code and they've put the code into the Sega Saturn version of the game, the original Sega Saturn Tomb Raider 1.
So on the Tomb Raider 1 engine, this is running on.
So basically, it's running, it's Tomb Raider 2 assets running in Tomb Raider 1's game engine. However, they have had to, you know, it's not as simple as that, you know, delete the code, put the code in kind of thing.
New graphics sorted, yeah.
Yeah, basically it runs. Tomb Raider 2 had a lot of dynamic lighting in it and like kind of dynamic, you know, textures, which basically the Sega Saturn probably wouldn't be able to run, like, you know, just straight porting over from like the PlayStation or PC version of the game. So they've basically had to make their own dynamic lighting into the game, which is kind of part of like the article, you know, kind of like the wow factor of it. It's not just like, oh, it's Tomb Raider 2 on the Sega Saturn. It's got really, really, really good lighting and lighting effects throughout the game. Obviously, one of the levels that always stuck out to me for Tomb Raider 2 was the underwater level, yeah, where I think it's like the shipwreck. Or it's not a shipwreck. It's like a, what is it? It's like a, is it a tanker or something. But anyway, watching the footage of that, where you're underwater and you're coming up from the water into the tanker and everything looks, you know, absolutely fantastic for the Sega Saturn. I must admit the textures from my mind's eye don't look as good as the PlayStation version. I never played the PC version. But it's interesting as well because I always remember Lara Croft looking slightly different in Tomb Raider 1 to Tomb Raider 2. And obviously this is Tomb Raider 2 code being played in Tomb Raider 1. And I feel like I can tell. Like, I don't know. I know, Ravi, you're quite familiar with both Tomb Raider 1 and 2. I don't know what you think, but I definitely feel like I could. It looks like Tomb Raider 1. Like, if that makes sense.
It's weird. I was a PlayStation guy, you know, never had a Saturn. But then later on, I got a Saturn and I had Tomb Raider 1 on there. And I fell in love with it more than the PlayStation version, actually.
Why?
I don't know. It's just got a really nice kind of vibe, even though it's the way that the polygons are drawn is completely different as well.
The quads, aren't they? Squares, yeah.
Yeah, and it looks very different, but it just had a good vibe. And just feeling that it was the original one. Also, the box was really nice as well. Core designs on that. This is really cool to see. I think the lighting's really impressive as well, but looking at it, the frame rate I'm really surprised with, because even playing the first one, it seemed a little bit slow on the Saturn, and it looks like there's been some improvements here. And this, it looks like it's a fan project that are doing this. Hats off to them, you know, like hopefully we'll see some more Tomb Raider stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But, it's just one guy actually. Yeah. Retro Raider John is his name. So okay. He's been working on this for about 3 years now.
And I forgot to mention as well, it's the full game. This isn't like a proof of concept. We've covered these in the past where it's like, oh, Metal Gear Solid running on the Sega Saturn, but it's just the first area, you know, or the first 20 minutes of the game. He's ported all 17 levels of Tomb Raider 2 to this. He says, you know, they're not finished. There's, you know, a lot of work to still be done, but they're all in some sort of explorable, playable state, which is, you know, fantastic, really.
Yeah, there are some bits, for example, he's struggling with, like, you know, floating islands, which is like apparently really laggy currently on the PlayStation. He's experimenting with reducing the draw distance, but he wanted it. He said it's not really up to playable standards then. So he has to think about a way to kind of optimize it for the Saturn's hardware. And things like, you know, the new weapons that were in the sequel are not in there yet. Sound effects need to be ported over as well. So there is still work to be done. But looking at it, I mean, like I said, he's been working on this for 3 years. It looks like most of the main hurdles are kind of overcome. It's just kind of getting those remaining bits.
He's previously done this as well with Tomb Raider Unfinished Business as well, about three years ago.
The PC DLC, well, I say DLC, the added content,
add-on.
PC, yeah, add-on. Yeah,
and he ported that over. So, you know, I guess the big hurdles have been adding the lighting and doing all the extra stuff like that. Also, he's talked about extra player animation that he's had to put in there. So, like, getting attacked by a shark and stuff like that, you know, there's got to be these new animation models.
I think it would be cool. I mean anyone that wants to play the original, you can play it really easily on PC, or, you know, everyone's got a PlayStation original in the cupboard somewhere, I'm sure. Have you ever played Tomb Raider 1 on the Saturn, Joe?
Behind me, but I don't think I've ever booted it up. I grew up with Tomb Raider. And I think I enjoyed watching my brother play it more than I ever played it. I actually bought the remaster, you know, the trilogy that came out a year or two ago. I bought that earlier this year because it was on sale, you know, on Xbox Marketplace. And I really struggled with it. And I felt so ashamed. Like, I played it for like 20 minutes and I was like, I can't get used to controls. It's coming from the guy who adores Resident Evil and tank controls.
Kind of tank controls, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I was really struggling with it. And I was like, I'm terrible at this. And I was like, I'll come back to it. And I haven't gone back to it yet. But Tomb Raider 1, 2, and 3, I feel like I played it loads. But it must have been watching my brother more than anything. I don't think I was ever that good at it. But yeah, no, we had them on PlayStation. We like I say, we didn't have Sega Saturn either. Same as Ravi, got one as an adult much later. But I have it because I went through a phase of like wanting to try and get every game that came out on both consoles.
Yeah.
So, and I'd like, well, I have both versions. I've got the PlayStation and the Sega Saturn version. Realized very quickly that that'd be really expensive. So,
yeah. You know. All those Japanese exclusives as well.
Like, yeah, oh, yeah.
Maybe not. But my memories are the same as you. My brother, it must have been Christmas 96, he got a PlayStation 1.
Mm-hmm.
And he got Tomb Raider with it. So that came out October 96. And I've got really vivid memories of that Christmas being in his room and him playing it and me just kind of watching, you know, being amazed at it. I remember because I still had an Amiga 1200 was my main system then, holding the PlayStation controller and being like, God, there's so many buttons. People keep track. I felt like an old man then. I was only a teenager.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was, yeah, again, I mean, my memory is probably similar as yours, watching my brother playing it more than actually playing it myself. Yeah. And I'm terrible at it as well. I mean, I'm not a big fan of tank controls personally.
Mm.
But I do know they are awesome games. And I think I've played the, I played it on the Saturn. I've got it on there. And I think like you said, Ravi, for me, it's cool seeing the original platform that it was developed for.
Yeah.
So I think that is a good thing about having them on that system.
Especially like with Toby Gard, like when you hear about his story and how he kind of got approached and you know, Core Designs and the kind of idea of Rick Dangerous as well. And that, that like a bit of, you know, old retro legacy in there. And yeah, it's really interesting. I'd love to get him on the podcast. Yeah. That would be great to talk about Tomb Raider, you know, from his creator.
Of course, we have done several Tomb Raider episodes with the core crew in the past. So we're going to get more of the inside story. Definitely have a look at the back catalogue. This is a work in progress, so it looks like he's very optimistic about it. He said it's coming together very nicely. So hopefully we will get that fully playable version of Tomb Raider 2 for the Sega Saturn at some point soon. So I'm going to read more about that. And of course, all the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week by putting them in the podcast show notes. And you can click through to the website at theretrohour.com. Little reminder as well that we do have a patron that supports this podcast. If you head to our website as well, theretrohour.com, you can back us on there. Really helps us out. Now that we are into, like you said, the 500s, Ravi, helps us keep the lights on for the next year.
I think the patrons have, you know, helped us for the past, well, since we started it, really.
5 years ago we've had patrons.
Yeah, 5 years ago. Effort. And, you know, it's a great community, but also we've got an extra podcast as well.
Yeah.
It's the After Hours podcast. And After Hours is a lot more casual than this as well. We kind of go into our own personal stories. We talk about, like, totally random subjects. Joe comes up with a lot of funny stories. I think it's really good, the After Hours podcast. I enjoy it, and we've got quite a lot of After Hours episodes as well. So if you do sign up, you can just sign up to a feed on your podcast app, and straight away you get access to all of them.
Yeah, we'd have like a custom RSS feed. You can just put it in, so it'll download them automatically onto your podcast app. We're going to be recording episode 50 of the After Hours as well this
month. Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of, they'll all unlock for you as well if you become a gold member or above. Also, patrons get an ad-free episode. We do a few extra news stories every week as well, just for our patrons. They're on the way in just a minute. So if you'd like to join our wonderful community, all the details to sign up are at theretrohour.com. And of course, the Hangout as well, where we basically do a massive Zoom call. Get as many of our patrons that want to come on and geek out for a couple of hours at the end of every month. Going to be doing that on the final weekend of October. So all the details to join us on there on our website right now. Okay, our special guest going to be getting part two of our chat with the legend that is Roger Hector. He's coming up on the podcast in just a minute. Before we do that, let's take a quick second to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor. And of course, it is a long-running sponsor, huge supporter of this podcast. It is our friends with the sound that we all know by now. Some mates at Shopify. Now, that is the sound of making a sale on Shopify. And the thing about it is, you might be listening to this thinking, well, I do a little bit of selling. Like my wife, she does like embroidery. sells a few designs on t-shirts. I've got a mate who makes his own like custom t-shirts and jewelry and that kind of thing. Shopify's perfect for you if you're at that level, but also massive household names use it as well, like Mattel and Gymshark. So however big you want to grow, Shopify will be there to grow with your business. And the great thing about it is it takes care of all the complicated stuff for you.
I think it's pretty amazing because, you know, when we talk about Shopify, people assume physical products, but digital products and digital delivery is really important. So you don't actually have to have, you know, an inventory in your house, stockpiling stuff. You can, you know, have a digital inventory of some of your works that you've created. You know, you can watermark them as well. You can have digital rights management, be able to sell them with instant delivery as well. So they'll get delivered straight away to your customers and, you know, they'll be able to download it from a link as soon as they purchased it.
I wish this was around when we did our book, because we did like an ebook version, didn't we?
Yeah.
I had to literally go through and email every single customer individually. This does it all for you. Great thing about it as well is it gives you a design studio. So there are hundreds of ready-to-use templates, and it really means that you can have a gorgeous online store matching your brand style, you know, your colors, your fonts in there as well. If you want to dig deep into the CSS and HTML, you can do that, but you don't have to. They all look beautiful. And it gives you AI tools that are really helpful as well, so it can help you with your product descriptions, your page headlines, even enhance your photography as well, and help you get the word out there as well. That is often a big problem for a lot of people starting a new company. It's doing the marketing, isn't it? Because it takes up so much time. But with Shopify, they can help you with your email and social media campaigns. So basically, wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling, Shopify will be there with you every step of the way. It's basically like having a commerce expert with world-class experience with everything from managing inventory, international shipping, even processing returns and lots more as well. So if you sell anything at all, you're ready for Shopify. Now, why don't you try our link? Helps out the podcast. They know that we sent you and that you can try it out for an incredible trial price, just £1 a month. So head to this link, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. The note that we sent you, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. I'll put that in the show notes and get ready to take your big business to the next level and hear a lot more of this. All right, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you on next Friday's podcast. And next, coming up part two of our chat with the legend that is Roger Hechter. He's coming up next.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're with the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here again with Roger Hechter, and we're going to be doing the conclusion to our absolutely amazing interview. You know, Roger's had such a big career. Last time we covered, you know, the coin-ops, the start of video games, the early days, and now we're getting into the consoles and that kind of era with, you know, Electronic Arts, which is a huge company. We've had Trip on the podcast, and we're just wondering, Roger, how you got involved then and how you started working with Trip Hawkins.
Well, that was, let's see. I wound up, EA was a relatively new company at that time. And so they were, they had gotten started. They had been publishing games. They had their own niche that they were pursuing. And I had heard about them. And when I left Bally, I went and talked to him. And one thing led to another, and they said, "Oh, geez, this would be great." I had an interesting interview with Trip, and I reported to him, and he was. He was very interested in the background that I brought to what they were doing, and I thought, well, this could be very cool. So I got started. I was basically handed or put in charge of the production of all sports, action, and arcade games. So they had other senior executive producers who were doing other categories of games, but those were the categories that were mine. And there already had been a couple of games that had been put in production that hadn't been launched yet in the sports world. And one of those, famous John Madden, was a, well, it was started by Tripp. And he actually brought some really unique and I thought interesting ideas for how to leverage value from these licensed sports celebrities.
I was wondering, did you work closely with Happy Keller at all? Because we've had him on the podcast. Yeah, and he's you know, mentioned the kind of whole EA Sports era and you know, that wonderful Madden connection as well.
EA Sports as a brand had not been established yet when I came there. It was all just EA and all these different games. We put a lot of effort into building a brand around these uniquely designed sports games. Madden was a good example of it, although it kind of started awkward. It was a little weird. It was originally designed to work on the Apple II. And the Apple II was a terrible graphics processor computer. I mean, you couldn't do much with it. And so the EA, the original EA game for John Madden, that was it. But I put some efforts into getting it on the Amiga, onto the Commodore 64, which was a much better graphics platform, and then evolving through time, but using the core concept that Tripp had, which was he wanted to try and find the value added by the celebrity sports people in the game, build that into the game. And John Madden, turns out, you know, they held meetings with him in the early days and asked him, what should we do here? And he was very openly contributing to make this video game, you know, work the way he would coach it to be. And that really added value. And Tripp gets the sort of the initial credit for forcing that as an issue, because a lot of celebrity-based licenses, you know, were just their name was stuck on the package without there being much of a contribution. But anyway, the EA Sports, the action and arcade games, those were, you know, there were all categories that I went into development. I focused on all of them, really, and I had a small team, and we contracted out with third-party development groups and wound up during the time I was there hiring and bringing staff on board that could actually do a lot of the work ourselves. And all of those things were becoming much more helpful, I think, through time.
And at the time, you know, in the early days of EA and around when you joined, etc., at the time, obviously, games were very much, you know, fantasy-based, action-based, etc. Did you think, you know, Tripp was crazy? You know, like, these are sports games. You know, obviously, you know, we all know, spoiler alert, it was fantastic in the end. You know, it did really well. But, you know, what was your kind of, like, feel of that and the community feel of that, of to, you know, kind of go down that sports direction and, you know, get PGA involved and Jordan versus Bird, etc.?
Well, one of the things I had learned, is that there are different markets. There are different audiences for different types and styles of games. And originally, in the very beginning, it was a very tiny little market because there just wasn't very much exposure for Pong, for example. But as the various categories of games started to evolve, you could see which ones were being successful. You could see, you know, what were the qualities that were appealing to different versions of audiences, different ages of players, different environments. You know, it's one thing if it's in a bar, it's another thing if it's in, you're playing it at home or at a party or, you know, various things like that. So, so understanding how the expanding market would evolve and projecting into that with products, with games that would appeal to that audience or those audiences, that was part of the job. So we worked on that.
And do you think your contribution to EA and the sports games, do you think that helped the kind of longevity, the long-term success of EA and EA Sports?
The original, I will say the original concepts were, you know, started with Nolan.
Okay.
No, not Nolan.
With
say
Trip.
It again. Yeah, Trip. Yeah, with Trip.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take any credit away from anybody. The kinds of things that I could see were what was working and what was doing really well, and I would leave that alone. But finding ways to improve on this or that, maybe it's a distribution problem, maybe it's an audience problem, maybe it's a technology problem, all of these various things were all different categories that had to be looked at. And trying to build a team that could leverage those experiences in an organized sort of way was a big piece of how to improve the category of games. And so EA was still a relatively fresh new company at the time I started there, but it also had issues and, you know, they had to evolve their whole system. And they did.
And they definitely, they started that kind of video game franchise style thing as well when they had, you know, some of the games coming out in like album covers originally and that, you know, a commercial look. I was wondering if when you later went on to Disney as well, that background of working with companies and that kind of commercial merchandising and looking at games really helped convince Disney to work with you.
Well, originally, when I joined EA was not focused on the bigger markets, in my opinion. They were focused on the personal computer world.
Yeah.
And they also didn't have teams internally being paid to develop these things. They used outside groups that the whole idea of promoting the developers as rock stars was an idea that EA adopted and used. And that's why when you see the album cover style album covers and that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
All of the guys that had worked on video games like at Atari, that no one ever heard of the people. They never heard of the people because it was all Atari. And EA, part of the attraction of developers to work on their own was to become stars themselves.
I think you're completely right, because with Atari, we've had a few guests on that have talked about hiding their initials in the game somewhere because Atari wouldn't let them actually display it. And there you've got slammed on the box on EA, the developer's name. Yeah.
Well, see, so all of that kind of melded together to distinguish EA, but EA did have to evolve into a greater focus on home consumer cartridge games. And that was a different kind of business, particularly when there was different technology that allowed for different levels of newer levels of graphics and things like that. So we having a really good general overview of where the market was and where it was going and all that kind of stuff was very relevant to educating both EA and ultimately Disney. Now, Disney, you asked me about Disney. I was very excited to be recruited by Disney. I'd been to Disneyland as a little kid. I watched Disney on TV. I'd been, you know, Disney movies and all that kind of stuff. So I was a fan of their, of what they'd done. But more importantly, I was familiar with the sort of scale and scope of their corporate business and their global market. Mm. And the global market of Disney is to this very day huge. Mm-hmm. And there's probably more businesses than you've heard of. But anyway, I was very excited to join Disney. And what their perception was that they were becoming old-fashioned and not the only way that Disney had participated in the electronic games world or interactive entertainment world was through licensing, you know, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. And there was a whole business internally called licensing that managed the Disney characters in these various applications. But it wasn't game design. You know, that didn't happen. So anyway, I came in to start up a new group that could create the games and also do some supervising of the licensing activities that were being done. There's some funny stories attached to all of that. But I was very excited to go there, and it was a very exciting trip. We started building essentially a producer team inside of Disney Interactive. We originally started as a division of their consumer products group, and eventually all of the, you know, we released successful game products out there that were in new Disney categories. Things like, had never been done before, things like preschool software for moms and dads that have a little child and will sit and play ABCs or 1-2-3s with Mickey Mouse on their computer screen and let the child engage, and it's a mother and father and child experience. And that kind of thing, nobody had ever done that, but we did it, and it was a hit.
It's interesting because in the first part of our interview, you talked about storyboarding, but you also talked about mascots and having those in video games. And then you moving to, you know, a company with the greatest mascot in the world, Mickey Mouse. So
exactly. Yeah.
It's an obvious transition. I was wondering then also about the Mickey Mouse games and producing those independent Disney titles for the Genesis. Were they kind of a bit worried, and did they think, you know, this wasn't an audience that they could hit?
Disney's interest in the license application of their property was very self-defensive. They didn't want someone else to screw up Mickey Mouse or leave a negative impression. So Disney's direction wasn't from an experienced game development person. It was applied by someone who could follow the rules exactly that were printed out. And that idea permeated the whole company, was to protect the reputations and the value of their properties. And that's understandable. That's cool. I didn't have a problem with that. I can say when I got involved in this, one of the license games being developed by Sega, turns out, was a Donald Duck game. And the developers were in-house at Sega, and they were developing this Donald Duck game. And they had created a section of the game where Donald has a club in his hands, and he walks around and he smacks baby seals. And when I saw that, I went, I think there's a problem here. We can't have Donald Duck smacking baby seals, because that was a whole big political disaster to happen. So there was always the potential of finding misuse of the characters by third parties, but that made the third parties, the licensees, kind of nervous about what they were trying to do, because they didn't want to screw up their, they didn't want to offend Disney. And I brought a little more game development consciousness into it. Mickey's Castle of Illusion was a great game. It was a hit game. It was a lot of fun. No clubbing baby seals or anything. I mean, it was all put together properly, and the success of that project reinforced to Disney that they could do this. They didn't have to give all the money away to somebody else. So we built this internal development division that built games, built sort of new category games, built software. We had one of my favorite projects was, it wasn't really a game. It was an educational program called the Animation Studio. And it was all about teaching the Disney style of animation.
I remember that. Was that one where you had different layers of paper in there, and you could flip between the paper? Yeah, exactly. That was fantastic.
It was just, well, and that, I mean, it was a big hit, and it reinforced lessons that were being taught internally at Disney for decades. Because Disney had hundreds of employees who were animators, and they had to teach them how to do it the Disney style. And I compressed all of that into a program that did a pretty good job of it. And you learned about techniques of animation, like there's a thing called a double bounce walk, you know, where Mickey walks in a double bounce walk. And how is that done? And you do that with the multiple sheets of paper, essentially layered on top of each other. Although there's no paper, it's all on a screen. And this was all before real computer animation took over, which is what it is now. But it was at that time, that was a sort of a historical introduction.
And I remember it looked stunning as well, because, there'd been other computer animation done. Eric Schwartz was one that we'd seen on the Amiga as well. And there were quite a few, but the Disney stuff, when it came out, it just looked fabulous, you know, especially using that program. I remember some of the example files on there were mind-blowing, seeing stuff from the Disney artists on PCs and Amigas and other personal computers at the time.
I enjoyed working at Disney. I met many, many really amazingly talented, creative people there. That's kind of an end career destination for hundreds and hundreds of people that work there and have amazing things to do.
So you mentioned Castle of Illusion starring Mickey Mouse there, which really got me excited. I even turned around when you mentioned the clubbing. I've got that Donald Duck game just up there. which I thought was great.
Clubbing is out of it now.
It's out of it, but on the front of the box, he still has a club in his hand. Which is funny. but yeah, Mickey Mouse, Castle of Illusion, huge game. Obviously, you're working at Disney at this point, and they're moving to internal production and development. Sega then, you know, start trying to pry you away. What's the story there? How did you get involved in Sega? Because obviously they've noticed you at this point. What happened there?
Well, I had worked with, I had established a relationship with Sega already, but it was also the case, and this is a kind of a weird story. It's more of a corporate politics story, but there was a time when the rise of the Disney software group became evident and obvious to all of the other divisions of Disney. Mm. And the head of the movie division said, geez, these game people are using cameras and scripts, and that's what we do, so they should be under us. Mm-hmm. And the consumer products division says, well, they're building consumer products, they should be working for us. And actually, it turned out that all of the various divisions of Disney were fighting to take control of us, of our group. And so I was instructed at one point to, okay, let's finish all our existing projects. Don't start anything new. We've got to figure out how the corporate direction needs to go, but you guys are all fine. You know, you'll still be on the payroll. And that all transpired in that way. We stopped building new products. We sold all of our existing products. And then it was during that time that they couldn't decide what to do next. That's when Sega stepped up and said, hey, we got you right now. They had their high-end R&D division called STI, mm-hmm. Sega mm-hmm. Technical Institute. Mm-hmm. The gentleman that had started that in Japan, a fellow named Mark Cerny, I had known him from our days working together at Atari way in the past.
Right, yeah.
And so Mark had decided to leave Sega, or yeah, Sega.
He's, yeah, we've had him on the podcast, actually. He's a really interesting guy, yeah.
Very interesting guy. Yeah. I wound up being offered the job he had, which was running STI. And we passed each other, you know, on his way out, I was walking in. And so, since I knew him, I chatted with him a bit just to find out what's going on. And I got the backstory, which was fine. That's all fine. So that's how I got connected into it. Mm. And, Sega was an amazing experience. Mm. It was quite unique. It was very highly regarded internally at Sega. We had the sort of the A team of the Sonic group, mm-hmm. Hirokazu Yasuhara, Kunitaki Aoki, and, the other guy's name. I'll think of it. Anyway. The three guys that were the key contributors to Sonic, and there was many more people that were added and supporting, but those guys, Yuji Naka, see? Mm-hmm. Naka, Yasuhara, and Aoki, they all were driving the bus, so to speak. I arrived there just before the launch of Sonic 2. Mm-hmm. And that was already underway. It was already took place. I didn't contribute to that, but I was to be in charge of everything that happened after that.
Mm.
And there was all kinds of drama, all kinds of different things. It was very, very ambitious goals established. One of them was Sonic was so successful on an annualized Christmas product basis that every year at Christmas time, there had to be another Sonic game.
Mm.
So that meant the core team had less than a year to do whatever they were going to do.
It's like a 9-10 months. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they also had the responsibility of building something that had more in it than had been done before.
Mm.
And all of those kinds of challenges sort of, well, partially fell on my lap to deal with trying to get more out of less time, less calendar time, bigger projects. The team itself was amazing in terms of what they could come up with in terms of ideas. But they came up with so many ideas for Sonic 3 that you couldn't do it in 1 year. You couldn't do it in 2 years.
Mm.
So we wound up having to do some back and forth negotiations on what do we do.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just the Sonic team, but other parts of Sega were always trying to contribute ideas,
mm-hmm.
which, okay, you kind of had to deal with a lot of sort of corporate politics, so mm-hmm. to speak. But I did enjoy it. It was an amazing experience. Had quite a time and managed to make some very successful things happen too.
Yeah. So, well, it's interesting because obviously you mentioned you came in right at Sonic 2. Sonic at that point taking over the world. You've gone from Mickey Mouse to Sonic the Hedgehog in the 90s, which is huge. And obviously you mentioned there the 1 year, you know, Sonic every year kind of thing. So I'm assuming that's where games such as Sonic Spinball and Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine came in to kind of plug the gap between Sonic 2 and Sonic 3. Before we get onto Sonic 3, I've just got so many questions because obviously you've worked for such big, iconic North American development studios, you know, Atari, EA, etc. What was it like suddenly working for, you know, Sega, you know, Japanese? Was it a completely different culture? Was it tough working between the two cultures, like Sega of America? And
it was a very new experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot about Japan culture.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, at one point, part of my mission was to be able to blend the Americans with the Japanese team members working together.
Okay.
And that really doesn't work very well if with the total language difference. So I started a regular weekly Japanese language learning session.
Love that.
for the Americans.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, we focused on the feelings, the connections, the life lessons needed by all of the players involved. So the Japanese and the, you know, the Americans. We also had several people from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just the United States and Japan. It was also Europe. And we sort of defined this as looking for global understanding and acceptance of Sega games,
mm-hmm.
expanding it to a global market that could be addressing any variety of different marketplaces. And that was part of the definition of STI, the Sega Technical Institute. So, yeah, work was put into that. I learned Japanese.
Yeah.
And I also spent some time in Japan. That I had different experiences than I was familiar with through high-end Japanese corporate culture, sort of behaved a little differently. But that's mm-hmm. okay. It was cool.
Mm-hmm.
But Sega overall, I also reported to a very well-adapted Japanese executive. There was challenge associated with blending who's who mm-hmm. and understanding what were the the goals and objectives and the mm-hmm. techniques of management for different, for the Japanese culture versus U.S. Now, I had Tom Kalinske in an office right next to the building that I was in mm-hmm. at STI, and Tom and the other executives at Sega of America. STI was not a division of Sega of America, even though we were located in America. We were our own little world. I was able to develop relationships easily within Sega of America. So it was actually a very successful and productive experience that required a lot of sort of learning new things.
So I wanted to get onto Sonic 3 before we finish, because obviously it was such a huge, iconic game. It came out in the 1993 holiday season in the end. What was that like, going through all these cultural differences, learning Japanese, trying to make that work between the Americans and the Japanese? Obviously, Sonic 1 and 2 were absolutely huge, blast processing, all that jazz. What was it like? What challenges did you face and anxieties, I guess, of, being the project manager of Sonic 3 and Sonic and Knuckles?
Sonic and Knuckles. Yeah, we had, there were a number of things that happened that had never happened before that wound up requiring creative responses and figuring it out. I think I don't know if I mentioned the whole Michael Jackson thing, but
we've got it there.
I can tell you that story.
That'd be great. That'd be great to hear your side of that. Yeah.
That started one afternoon. I get a phone call from someone who is telling me that to expect a visit from Michael Jackson at STI.
Mm-hmm.
I said, really? And what's that all about? And I got no more information.
All right.
So it turns out Michael Jackson was a real heavy-duty Sonic fan.
Mm.
He bought all the games. He had them all. He played them all. He loved Sonic more than anything else. And he wanted to come to meet the team that did that because he respected that. He wanted mm-hmm. to expose himself to the team.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he wanted. And once I had that explained that way, I said, well, okay, come on down.
Mm-hmm.
His bodyguards and such arrived in the afternoon after work. Now, we didn't want to attract any media into that. This was just a private intro mm-hmm. Thing and giving Michael Jackson as a fan the opportunity to meet the team. So he came. I showed him around. He was very soft-spoken, very nice guy, very fancy celebrity characterization at all. But we wound up in our conference room with the Sonic team,
mm-hmm.
and I introduced them. I said, this is Michael Jackson. You've probably heard of him, and this is the Sonic team. And they all joined into their own conversation, and ultimately, one of the guys in the Sonic team said, hey, Michael, why don't you do the music for the next Sonic game? And he thought about it for about 2 seconds and said, okay, I'll do it all. And normally that kind of negotiation would take place between attorneys across a span of weeks, right? Mm. Now this is just done. Mm-hmm. And so Michael agreed to do the music for Sonic 3. And that resulted in him doing an amazing job. The actual soundtrack for Sonic 3 had the Michael Jackson sound to it, but it also sounded appropriate for the Sonic game. Mm-hmm. So it was about as perfect as I could imagine it to be. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, very shortly before the Christmas season launch of the game, there was some bad PR that about Michael Jackson that caused the Sega company to go, oh no, no, we can't be, we can't be a part of that. And so it fell on me to get my own in-house music composer, who was really good, but not well known, to actually remove all of the existing music in the Sonic game and replace it. We had to keep him there day and night, passing food under the door, you know. he had to... He had this impossible task to accomplish, and he took it on, and he did it, and it was great. Mm. And so that's the music. It was all done in the last tiny second. The first 6 months were invested in making it all wonderful through Michael Jackson, but it didn't work out. So that's how that happened.
I've got one last question before we're going to talk about your latest project at Adventure Valley, and this was just... Sonic and Knuckles, when you first saw the kind of ability to be able to place an old character, a new character into one of the old games and kind of like retroactively have those games and those products, you know, updated, what did you think about it? And how did you kind of approach it when you first saw it?
Originally, I thought it was a really good idea. If you can leverage the popularity and the awareness of a successful intellectual property character, that's cool. Now, what you actually do with it, you know, the details of how it comes together and how it works, that still has to work mechanically inside a game. Mm. But I always liked Knuckles. I thought he was a cool character myself. I like Tails.
Yeah.
Tails are very appealing. And giving him the ability to be able to fly was a great idea. Mm. Let him perform differently on the screen than Sonic, you know, necessarily. Knuckles as a, you know, as a boxer, as a puncher, I thought he had a good character. He was more limited than Tails, but I thought it was okay.
Well, we've covered so much. It's been fantastic for you know, you doing this, Roger, and actually coming on the podcast and sparing your time, which is just amazing. We also love that you're still in the video game industry as well. In a kind of educational aspect as well. So tell all of our listeners about your latest project.
Latest project. This has been going on for the last couple of years. The Charitable Singleton Foundation approached me a few years ago and asked if I could help them create an entertaining educational game that would make the world a better place. That's what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, we talked about it and one thing led to another. And I said, yeah, I can do that. And so this was resulted or has resulted. I put together teams and, you know, there were marketing people in a whole organization kind of built around this. But the game is called Venture Valley, and it's free to the world. Costs nothing. There are no ads in it. There's no purchasing upgrades. So it's really a gift from the singletons to the rest of the world. But what it does, the singletons wanted it to teach subjects that typically are not taught in school,
right?
That are still valuable. And the two they wanted featured were entrepreneurism and financial literacy.
Mm.
You go, wow, that sounds like fun. You know, how do you make that fun? Well, mm-hmm. that was the challenge. And so what wound up coming together, it was a kind of a challenge, but I put together teams. I created the core concept. There is a game that works on PCs and cell phones. And like I say, it's free, and you can play against multiple opponents simultaneously, competing against each other's starting a business. So you get to start a business, and there are many businesses, and some of them are funny. Some of them are kind of wacky. Others, mm. you still have to learn and understand the principles of profit. You know, what's the difference between net profit and gross profit? Mm-hmm. Well, most high school and college students don't even really know if you ask them that question. And so there's a whole series of lessons to be learned in the game that will allow you to be successful competing against your opponents. And there's another piece of this that became a key part of it, is that the whole esports world has been exploding over the last few years. And esports, turns out, can be sponsored through esports styles, can be sponsored by universities or corporations. Mm. And these sponsored tournament events are being held, have been held now out in the world with, you know, you can win $10,000 prize by beating the opponents in an esports style event of playing Venture Valley.
Wow.
And that has been amazing.
Mm.
It's just in the last year, the game itself has won a series of awards.
I'm looking at the site at the moment, and you've just got tons of awards on the site.
Yeah,
and they're all really huge as well. It looks like it's fantastic as well, when, you know, available for everyone just to get on the App Store or whichever system you're using, you know, on Steam as well.
Well, and it's been expanding beyond just the United States market, because one of the last things I did there before stepping back was close the deal with the country of Poland, who wanted to have Venture Valley as a part of their curriculum in all their public schools. Great.
Mm.
So anyway, having an impact on society is something that's going on. Now, having said all of that, it's still a game. It still looks and feels like a game. It plays like a game. You can get frustrated and lose, or you can get aggressive and win. But right now, I'm kind of looking forward into the world of AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And seeing some of the capabilities of AI to add even more value to that kind of project is very, very substantial.
I think you've added a lot to the world of gaming, and you've definitely made it a lot more exciting for us, and it's great to see that you're adding to the world of education as well. Thank you so much, Roger. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Not a problem. It's a pleasure.